Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, my name is Paul Moeller, counsel for the petitioner Musa Karama. In this appeal of a FERC order assessing a penalty of $50,000 against Mr. Karama for violating Section 35.41B of the Commission's regulations, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Among other things, the assessment order under appeal in this case failed to provide Mr. Karama a hearing as requested under Section 31 of the Federal Power Act, erroneously ruled against Mr. Karama by summary disposition, applied an interpretation of Section 35.41B as a strict liability rule that is vague, overbroad, and inconsistent with FERC's own regulatory history, and is frankly a little bit confusing as well, failed to consider Mr. Karama's experience or lack thereof in evaluating his motive, intent, and particularly given contradictory evidence provided by Mr. Karama as part of an affidavit in this case, and did not adequately consider or explain how it took into account Mr. Karama's financial circumstances in arriving at the penalty amount. With respect to those financial circumstances, the FERC order adopts exactly the FERC enforcement staff recommendation for a penalty of $50,000 and adopts the exact payment schedule proposed by the commission staff. Mr. Karama in his affidavit explained his financial circumstances. Staff in its order said we took that into account, but that's all it said. It gave no indication of how it considered the circumstances Mr. Karama described, in which he explained that he was in debt, he was behind on mortgage payments, and he was currently living paycheck to paycheck. The commission simply adopted the $50,000 penalty. In paragraph 55 of the order, the commission identifies five issues that they specifically find Mr. Karama, or five violations that Mr. Karama allegedly committed. Averaging out, that's $10,000 per violation for a filing that Mr. Karama made that he did not need to make to perform the activities he was interested in performing, that he amended because he thought he was required to amend it, and that he subsequently sought to withdraw. He essentially dipped his toes in FERC's regulatory waters, tried to pull them back out, and has been caught in those waters ever since. Section 31 of the Federal Power Act is a unique provision. It let us bring this appeal directly to this court without going through the usual rehearing process required of virtually every other FERC order. It provides respondents to FERC's determinations that a penalty should be assessed two procedural paths. Respondent can either go directly to district court and get a trial de novo on both the facts and the law, or a respondent can elect a trial at the FERC before an administrative law judge, receive those findings by the administrative law judge, and then receive in due course an assessment order that shall include those administrative law judge proceedings. That is, this provision evinces a concern with due process that wasn't provided.
Where did he invoke that provision? Where did he invoke the request for a hearing?
Your Honor, in his response to the commission's show cause order, he explicitly elected a hearing. That's in the title of his response.
So this is at JA 55, where it says, for these reasons, this commission should dismiss the present enforcement action or in the alternative impose compliant procedures. If the commission determines to proceed, the request elects an administrative hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so the commission says, well, if you read what he said elsewhere, there are no disputed facts here. So even under our administrative procedure, we can proceed by a summary judgment process.
Your Honor, I view that as a sleight of hand by the commission. Mr. Crum asked for summary disposition. He agreed with a specified set of facts that, in his view, it viewed favorably to him.
But in the commission's view, it cut against him.
In the commission,
he was asking for summary disposition. They granted a summary disposition, just not the one he wanted. That happens when you have uncontested facts and you put them before a trier of fact. Yep, no dispute here, and the law is different than you would suppose.
Your Honor, we would disagree that the facts are not in dispute.
What facts do you think are in dispute?
Your Honor, we give examples of the facts in an answer that was rejected by the commission and in our briefs. But for example, whether or not Mr. Karama deliberately and knowingly, words that used by the commission, acted in the way he did.
That's a legal question because the commission's view is that 35.41 does not require deliberately. On the knowingly side, he said in his affidavit, and he said in his in the document you were pointing to, that he doesn't dispute what was put in part three of the staff's paper, that he put down these two individuals, neither of whom really had anything to do with the company, and he listed them as president and as managing director. He knew that they were not. He may not have known whether that was bad or not. He may not have intended to hurt the commission, but the rule is, according as a matter, a legal question, which we do have to consider, that you don't have to do that. All you have to do is show that the seller didn't exercise due diligence to prevent such an occurrence.
Your Honor, we will get to section 35.1. Or 35.41 in the intent requirement.
But now we're on the question of what additional facts. If the commission is right about its view of 35.41, then what other fact is important?
Well, for example, the commission indicates that he represented himself as Ms. Dictone Dennis.
The commission says he acknowledged that, and you said, maybe it is you. In your motion that you were not disputing anything in that section of the, except as otherwise noted in this response, Mr. Karama admits the facts as presented by OE staff in section 3A.
Well, that's not a complete statement of what we said, Your Honor. We said he admits the facts but does not agree with or accept any of the inferences or conclusions drawn by the OE staff in that section.
Well, which part of that section about the back and forth with respect to the emails is an inference rather than a fact? So at page JA-10, I guess, it says, I don't know if it's JA, I guess it's JA-10, says, Mr. Karama has admitted to staff that while with Energy Endeavors, he used this one-year-old's name to hide his participation. Additionally, in response to staff's preliminary findings letter, he admitted that he was the principal organizer. Staff also found Mr. Karama represented to PGM employees in emails and on phone calls that he was Dennis or Mr. DeConte Dennis so as to conceal his participation.
We would assert, Your Honor, that the so as to conceal is an inference or conclusion drawn from the fact. But the fact that he represented himself as Ms. Dennis is not necessarily a fact that can be construed against him.
So he concedes that in emails to PGM employees, he represented that he was somebody he wasn't, correct? He concedes that much.
He concedes that he, yes, Your Honor.
And so the question for us is that enough?
And that we would argue that it isn't. Dennis may well have authorized those communications and understood he would be making communications.
But he also conceded that Dennis had nothing to do with the company.
I don't know that he's completely conceded that, Your Honor. Ms. Dennis certainly did have something to do with the company, and had the company thrived and succeeded, could well have benefited from the company. Those are facts that just aren't in this record at this point, Your Honor, and that Mr. Karama ought to have a hearing.
Is he going to dispute that she was the manager of the company? Is he going to say she was really the manager of the company?
Your Honor, I can't answer what Mr. Karama might or might not say at hearing, but I believe that that is a reasonable assumption that he could say that at hearing, that fact is not really in the record before you today.
The fact that she didn't really have anything to do with the company isn't in Part 3 of the staff report and recommendations with which he didn't dispute the facts?
Well, she had agreed to act as a manager in the company. He was going to manage the day-to-day affairs and the trading, and her ultimate role had the company gone forward, I think, is unclear.
Well, it says staff confirmed that DeConti Dennis was listed as the president, vice president, manager, was merely an acquaintance of Mr. Karuma's wife, and Ms. Dennis was completely unfamiliar with Quantum's business and only signed her name or Imani Kale's name as instructed by Mr. Karuma. Those are all facts. Is there a dispute about that?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, the commission went on to rule by summary disposition, and we would argue that when they ruled by summary disposition, they, after saying that they would look at the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Karama, in fact, they looked at the facts in the light least favorable to Mr. Karama time and again through the body of their order. They continually assert that it was Mr. Karama's intent, that he acted knowingly and willfully, that they impute a motive to Mr. Karama that just is not reflected in the record of this case. And that is inconsistent with summary disposition standards, where you should look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And Your Honor, I see my light's on, but if I can continue and discuss Section 35.41B of the Commission's regulations, which the Commission now views as a strict liability rule. That is, they have stated in this case, we believe this is the first case in which they've stated it, that intent is not a requirement under Section 35.41B of the Commission's regulations. That is inconsistent with the way the rule was viewed in 2003 and 2004 by a commissioner at that time, contemporaneously.
All right, by a single commissioner, and the commission has said their due diligence exception they think is sufficient to protect against, quote, strict liability where, in fact, efforts were made not to conceal material information from the commission.
Yes, Your Honor. I view this as a burden-shifting provision. That is, the due diligence exception moved intent into that section, and we would not disagree with that. But what the commission now says is there is no intent.
Is there a difference between intent and knowledge, in your view? Mm-hmm.
Intent, scienter,
what's knowledge. Intent to do what?
The intent to misrepresent the commission.
Well, if you make a knowing, says a seller must provide accurate and factual information. And if you knowingly do not provide accurate and factual information, is that the same thing as you did it with intent, or is that a separate question?
If you do it knowingly, I think.
Yeah, if you know that Dennis is not the managing director, and you write down that Dennis is the managing director, is there still some more intent that needs to be proven?
Well, Your Honor, that's a question relating to the filing itself, and we would argue another question of fact is that he filed his application based on the company Quantum Energy that was created, and he filed that application that described accurately the company as it was created.
As it was registered in Delaware or wherever?
It was registered in Delaware under his daughter's name, yeah. Yes, Your Honor. So Section 35.41B, as it was originally conceived in 2003 and 2004, before the Energy Policy Act of 2005, clearly, in our view, did have embodied in it an intent requirement. As far as I'm aware, there's no statutory provision that would have given the Commission authority to do anything else at that time. If the Commission wants to change that, it can certainly do so or seek to do so through the rulemaking, notice and comment rulemaking process. It hasn't done so here. What it did is it simply asserted there's no intent requirement in a policy statement, and then, based on that assertion, applied it to Mr. Karama in this case. And we would urge the Court to reverse the Commission on that basis.
All right.
Unless there's anything else, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Kennedy on behalf of the Commission. With respect to Section 35.41B, I would initially note that there's absolutely nothing on the face of the regulation that supports Mr. Karuma's argument that it is strictly limited to those submissions that were specifically and perhaps solely intended to mislead the Commission.
About knowledge. So what about just plain knowledge? What if you put something down that was not accurate, but you didn't know that it wasn't accurate?
Well, again, there is nothing on the face of the statute that, the regulation that limits it only, it limits its applicability only to the knowing submission of false and misleading information. And in fact, when the Commission was adopting Market Rule 3, there were comments from interested parties saying, you know what, it's overbroad.
Didn't the Commission say that the codicil at the end takes care of the knowing problem?
Correct. It could, if there was inadvertent submissions, and you could demonstrate.
So if it was inadvertent, then you didn't know, right? So that suggests there is a knowing requirement.
It could. If there was an inadvertent submission of false and misleading information, you could be exempted from liability.
If you actually know, then of course you can't exercise due diligence to prevent it because you know. So that somebody who actually knows is covered.
Correct.
So who is covered who doesn't actually know? Somebody who is negligent about filing a form.
Well, it would be right? Somebody
who writes down the company earns $50 million, doesn't know that it actually earns $10 million, but doesn't look to find out. That person would be covered because that person didn't exercise due diligence, correct?
Correct, but there could be a circumstance where an entity has procedures in place where when information is being submitted.
Yes. And but in a case where somebody knows that they're doing it, the whole thing is sort of irrelevant.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And rather than put that in, the Commission rejected the suggestion that it be limited to knowing submissions and said to the extent issues about intent arise, we can evaluate it under the due diligence standard. And in this regard, I would just note that when the Commission limits or is intending to prohibit intentional conduct, it does so explicitly. If you look right under the duty of candor we're speaking about in this case at Section 35.41C, the Commission speaks about the submission of false and misleading information to publishers of price indices, and it limits the application of that rule to the knowing submission of false and misleading information to publishers. Similarly, in Market Rule 2, which was adopted at the same time as the precursor to Section 35.41B, the Commission prohibited certain transactions that were, quote, intended to manipulate market prices. And again, there's no similar language in Market Rule 3 or Section 35.41B. As to the suggestion that the Commission engaged in some sleight of hand here, I would urge the Court to look at the ordering paragraphs in the show cause order, A and B. They directed Mr. Karuma. They laid out the facts. They directed him to submit an answer specifically admitting or denying those facts, raising any legal defenses he may have, and also bringing forth any information he wants to the commission to establish why a $50,000 penalty isn't warranted. Even before it got to that point, he had an opportunity under the commission's regulations to submit a response to the staff's report, essentially a well submission. And when the commission issued the show cause order, if you look at footnote 7, it told them, if you don't specifically admit or deny the facts here and just treat it as a general denial, summary disposition is a possibility. So Mr. Kuruma chose his fight. He decided to admit all the facts in the staff report. He submitted an affidavit that furthers those admissions.
The statute does call for findings by an ALJ. What?
It does, and we would submit that the language of Section 31D2 doesn't preclude the use of summary judgment procedures. And the reasoning is as follows. It speaks both 316A, which incorporates the procedures of 31.
Are you aware of any instances where a summary procedure is done by an ALJ, or is the very nature of an ALJ fact-finding?
Well, there I believe there could be.
Why couldn't that have happened here? Why?
Well, it certainly could have, but the commission had before it the facts as alleged by the staff, Mr. Kuruma's admissions to those facts, his defenses, and his statement that there are no...
Can he argue he's entitled to a look by the ALJ before a look by FERC?
Well, the commission found that holding the hearing at this point would just be a waste of resources. We don't need to go through that process. We could just decide these issues of law in the first instance.
Could the ALJ have a summary procedure?
It is permissible for the ALJ to...
ALJ to get the materials and say, we don't need to have a hearing, I can rule on this.
Well, and then you would have the further step that the commission would have to affirm
right.
the ALJ's decision, then perhaps rehearing from there. But the commission's...
So the ALJ has authority to do that, to do a summary proceeding without evidentiary hearing?
Yes. Under Rule 217 of the commission's Rules of Practice and Procedure, the commission itself, on its own motion, could do it, or the decisional authority, which could be the ALJ.
Is the commission's review of the ALJ's factual determinations de novo?
There is generally some deference given to the ALJs, particularly on matters of credibility and things like that. But it does take a fresh look at the facts.
Is there a regulation about that?
I do not believe there is, but I'm not certain. I believe it's just a matter of precedent derived through various orders looking at ALJ decisions. We would note that Section 31D2 speaks of an opportunity for hearing, and there are numerous cases that we discuss in our brief where this court and the Supreme Court and other appellate courts have made clear that opportunity for hearing does not guarantee a full evidentiary hearing in all circumstances, that the opportunity for hearing can be conditioned effectively upon the demonstration of a material fact in dispute. And Mr. Kuruma, again, admitted all the facts in dispute. Admitted that there were no material facts in dispute and only questions of law for the commission to resolve. Now, I would note that there was some discussion of what exactly he admitted to. The issue is, of course, whether he submitted false and misleading statements to the commission. He does not dispute that he used the name of his one-year-old daughter and Miss Dennis to cloak his involvement in Quantum Energy. He doesn't contend that those names mistakenly got on there. And I know that there was some attempt to walk back exactly what he did admit to earlier today, but it's a little late in the day to particularly parse sentences in the staff report and say, well, I do admit to this part, but I think maybe that's an inference here. Again, he was directed to identify all material facts that are in dispute, and rather than do so, he admitted that he agreed with the facts as presented by the staff. With respect to the penalty, at the time the commission assessed the penalty, it had before it, again, Mr. Kuruma was instructed to bring before the agency any facts he thought bared on whether to impose a penalty or how much it should be. So it did have his affidavit, which laid out his financial situation. It also had his response to the staff's report, his well submission, which included some documentation from his mortgage companies. And the commission found that any issues with respect to his financial status could be dealt with through an installment plan. The penalty itself is well justified. The commission found that there were five violations, not even considering the number of times that he communicated with PJM via phone and email in the name of Ms. Dennis. The violations took place over a number of months. They were serious. The duty of candor is something that the commission takes extremely seriously, and it's a fundamental basis of using competitive markets to set just and reasonable rates. We depend on parties to be truthful with each other and certainly truthful with the commission so that its oversight role can be carried out.
If the staff had said 100,000, we'd be in the same position.
Well, the commission takes an independent look at that, and I mean, I think either number could be justified. Obviously, the cap is the $1 million per day, and the commission has wide latitude underneath that cap to fashion an appropriate penalty, and I think what it did here falls well within that latitude.
And it doesn't have to explain anything further.
Well, I think it did. I think what it has to do is do what Congress instructed it to do, consider the seriousness of the penalty and the efforts to remedy it in a timely fashion.
Now, what about the commission's reliance on deterrence of others?
Well, I think that is something the commission noted when it responded to Mr. Kruma's request.
So the $50,000 was independent of that?
The decision, as I read the commission's orders, the decision to impose a penalty as opposed to some compliance measures was driven in part by the need to deter the conduct both by Mr. Kruma and also to signal to the industry at large that this is serious offense.
You cite two cases, but neither of them say that the commission is authorized to consider deterrence of others. And in Clifton Power, we left that question open.
Well, I believe Clifton Power does not address that. I think the issue there was whether
if you talk about deterring others, then you're into a different type of penalty.
Well, I think there may be an issue if the commission were to say these violations, in similar circumstances, we impose $100 per misstatement, but we really want to signal to the industry that this is a problem, so we're going to bump it up to $100,000. I think there might be an issue there, but here the commission just said we are going to impose this penalty as opposed to some compliance measure. Because the penalty itself is justified under the statute.
And a compliance measure would be in the nature of what?
Well, that was sort of the commission's point. On the one hand, Mr. Kruma is telling us that he's no longer in the industry. This isn't going to happen again. So what could we really do? But it could be tell us what your procedures are going to be for regulating your communications with the commission, document that you're following it, and things of that nature.
I just want to be clear, were we to deny the petition, then is the commission going to cite this as the court saying it has authority to impose fines to deter others?
Well, I think
he challenges that.
He does, and I think the fact that the commission is authorized to impose civil penalties, I think inherent in that is the ability to consider deterrence. That's what civil penalties are.
About, you know, the fact that I'm going away for 20 years is going to tell other people, don't do what I did. That's one kind of deterrence. And then the other kind of deterrence is you're going away for 30 years because the extra 10 years will send a message to society.
Right. And as I said, this is not that case.
And we know that because?
Well, because I think if you look at paragraphs 54 and 56 of the assessment order, which are at J176 and 177, when the commission talks about deterrence, mm-hmm. it's in the context of responding to Mr. Kuruma's argument or contention that there shouldn't be any penalty. Whatever the penalty is, it shouldn't be imposed here because there should be other.
Well, in specific response to this question about whether it's to to encourage compliance by others as compared to sending a message. It says in paragraph 54, the imposition of the proposed, I take it this is the only part that has anything to do with deterrence. Says the imposition of the proposed penalty here will encourage other entities to cautiously avoid the submission of false or misleading information to the commission in the future, whether resulting from negligence or otherwise. That's the only reference. Am I wrong? Is there another reference to deterrence other than that?
There's also the very end of paragraph 56, where the commission says, we believe that the imposition of a civil penalty is more likely to impact respondents' behavior as well as the behavior of other market participants.
Right. So, but in each case, it's not sending a general message. It's to tell other market participants.
In other words,
it falls within what Judge Rogers was asking.
Yeah.
Well, I think it is sending. Maybe I'm not understanding what you mean by
general. Sending a message to other market participants not to file false statements, but it's not sending some greater message like we hate liars in general or something like. I'm not sure what it means to say society in general, but in this case,
it's certainly
trying to tell other people who file documents with the commission that they will not get a pass if they lie on the documents.
Certainly. And the commission, again, said that is one of the reasons why we're imposing the civil penalty here as opposed to some other
measure. I read
your
brief, though, just to say you thought the commission could do a deterrence part, and that's all I wanted to clarify. In other words, if the record showed that normally, traditionally, the commission had imposed a $25,000 fine for this kind of misrepresentation, lack of candor, but now we're going to send a message to the industry, so this is a $50,000 fine. That's
correct. That's not our case here.
Yeah. So you weren't arguing the commission had authority to do that.
No, I think we're arguing.
It was not necessary for you to argue that.
Correct. All right. Correct. But it's not improper in determining whether to go one way or the other. If the penalty is justified, that deterrence is one factor to consider.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel for petitioners.
Your Honor, I'll be brief. Counsel indicated that the commission took an independent look at the issues in this case, particularly the penalty, but in fact it adopted exactly what its Office of Enforcement recommendation was. There really was no independent look here, and that is why, in our view, it's important that Mr. Karama have his day in court. It's provided for by Section 31 of the Federal Power Act, and this is not a case where that's an empty exercise.
Actually, they said more than that. I mean, they have a whole paragraph saying, coming to our conclusion, that it's a fair and reasonable penalty. They
say that, Your Honor, but then they don't identify, they have no discussion on the basis for how they got to that penalty, other than, I think they say it's the totality of the circumstances, but there's no discussion that relates to Mr. Karama's affidavit, for example, to his specific financial circumstances, to the reasons other than, you know, the general statement that they evaluate.
Says in light of the number of violations and the seriousness of the conduct.
Yes, Your Honor. But there's no discussion other than that. There's no weighing of the financial issues presented by Mr. Karama.
And well, they do respond to the financial by saying the way we're going to respond to that is by stretching out the payments. So doesn't that suggest that they've considered it, and that's the way they've resolved it?
Your Honor, that suggestion was made by their staff, and they did adopt that suggestion. Mm-hmm. But $5,000, $9,000 for every year thereafter. To somebody who's living paycheck to paycheck, may just result in another violation of the commission's rules when that payment can't be paid.
He hasn't lost his talents.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He hasn't lost his talents. He has his experience. He made a lot of money.
He made a lot of money while he was working for his previous employer. some of that money went into his business.
Sure, and the litigation, and, right, yeah.
And it certainly isn't there anymore. Right. Unless there's anything else?
No, we'll take the case under advisement. Thank you.
I'll grab that.